This is the Old Timers Talk at the January 2000 Tyler Anniversary, number 53. Speakers include Sonny B., Les W., and Cersei W.
I was at a group called Alcoholics Anonymous. With the help of Al B. of Dallas, Doc B. of Palestine, and Martin H. of Nacogdoches, the first organized meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was held at the Blackstone Hotel in January of 1947. The group called itself the Downtown Group and met regularly over Neil Simpson's drugstore on North Broadway. Leroy N. was their first newcomer. They held their first AA anniversary to inform the citizens of Tyler about Alcoholics Anonymous. From this meager beginning, the anniversary has grown to over 1,200 people in the 90s, with many groups supporting this effort. Okay, now it's time to get Mr. Jim P. up here, and he's going to introduce the first speaker. Jim?
All right. Come on up.
Hi, folks. My name's Jim, and I'm an ordinary alcoholic. He just gave me another assignment before I get to introduce the speakers, and that is to read the preamble. Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Let's do the serenity prayer. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I just realized I was saying that with we and us, God grant us the serenity. And years ago I heard a priest talking, and he said that serenity prayer had to be written by an alcoholic, because he said, God grant me the serenity. And if you look in the 12 and 12, they got it in there in two different places. One says, God grant me, and the other one says, God grant us. And I always choose the us, because that just feels a little bit better. I'd like to add my welcome to Robert's welcome there, welcome to the so-called old-timers meeting. And I want to thank Edna for asking me to participate in this. It's always a privilege to be asked to participate in an AA meeting. We had a last-minute cancellation. If any of y'all are looking for Odetta up here, that ain't Odetta down on the end. I know they favor a little bit, but that's Sonny B. And Sonny B stepped forward here at the last minute and volunteered to help us out. And would you come up and do that for us? Thank you, Sonny. Yeah.
I am Sonny, and I am an alcoholic. Odetta's got the flu bug, but I was in the old downtown group 35 or so years ago when Odetta came in for her first meeting. Gerald W. brought her in. I didn't think the woman would live the rest of the week, so she's not as bad as with the flu as she was then. She'll make it. She'll be all right. How it works, fifth chapter of the big book. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. But we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nailed until we let go absolutely. Remember that we are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask his protection with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Number 10, continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong, properly admitted it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us explain, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make three pertinent ideas: that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and that God could and would if he were so.
Thank you, Sonny. I appreciate that. I don't want y'all thinking that I'm an Al-Anon reject up here. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm a down-on-the-ground kind of alcoholic. And I wound up on the ground a lot, but one of my most memorable times was in Baytown, Texas, and we were having a convention down there, and the booze was free. And any time the booze was free, I'd be down on the ground a lot quicker. And that day, I was down on the ground, and the police came by, and they said, told my buddy, he said, y'all get in the car. He said, well, we can't get in the car because I can't get him up. And so policeman told me, said, get up. I said, I can't get up. So the policeman had to get out and help my buddy put me in the police car. And he took me back to the motel. That's what they did down there. But that's the way I did my drinking. But I haven't been down on the ground where I couldn't get up for 28 years. And I'll tell you something else. I haven't thrown up. I haven't thrown up for 28 years, and I ain't been thrown out of no place for 28 years. And I used to get thrown out on a regular basis. They call me old garbage mouth at some of those places. Somebody get old garbage mouth the hell out of here, you know. And I haven't gone in a place where they tell me, you can't come in here, get out. I remember one time I just got my nose in the door, and the bartender saw me, and he said, hey, you get out of here. And I said, who, me? Yeah, you, get the hell out of here. You can't come in here. It would have helped me a lot better if I had known what I had done. But I've always thought it was sort of a case of mistaken identity, because, he was downright adamant about that. I want to know if there are any newcomers here with less than, I don't want to offend anybody, but I'm going to ask for newcomers with less than a year's sobriety. Would y'all hold up your hands? Look at that, we got quite a few. Well, that's just really good. Well, let's don't leave out the old timers. They said that the requirement on this was over 20 years. Do we have any others out there? I know we do, but let's see the hands of those that have been sober more than 20 years. My goodness, pretty good crowd of them. Well, for the newcomers, there's 175 years of sobriety up here on the stage. And I didn't even count Robert. Lord knows how many he's got. But 175 years, and I like to think of this old-timers meeting as sort of a demonstration to the newcomers that AA works. The message is this, and take this home with you. If this motley-looking crew can stay sober for 175 years, then surely you're going to be able to stay sober for 4 or 5 years. And that's the way that goes. I heard a preacher say one time, he said, Methuselah lived to be 969 years old, but said, as best I can tell, that's the only thing the man ever did. He just was around here a long time. And he talked about the missed opportunity. He said, look at all the good the man could have done, all the people he could have helped. But he didn't. He just lived a long time. And I know that there are a few Methuselahs around AA. There ain't a whole lot of them because they tend to get drunk. But there's a few of them that just around here for a long time. But I can assure you that there ain't a single Methuselah up here on this stage. I know these guys, and they are active in AA. Cersei, bless his heart, he goes to about 14 meetings a week, if you can believe that. But of course, it looked like he uses 14 meetings a week. But you know what? They're active, and maybe that's why they've been sober for a long time. I want to introduce our first speaker. And by the way, I noticed, as I'm sure you've noticed, that the longer a person stays sober, the longer the story gets. And I know some people, they can probably talk 4 or 5 days, you know, without ever sitting down. But I've asked these guys to give us the 20-minute version, and they've kind of agreed to do that. Now, this first speaker, I said these others are busy. Now, this guy is plumb busy. I mean, everywhere you go, you look at the bulletin board, and it's Les W. is coming. At the end of the meeting, are there any announcement? Yes, Les W. is coming, or Les W. just left, you see. In fact, I was went to a meeting the other day, and I went in the bathroom, and I was catching up on my reading there on the wall. I do that a lot. And right there in the middle of all this writing, there it was. Les W. was here. You know, you used to see Kilroy was here, but there he was. Somebody said, you know, that guy's about like horse manure to rodeo. You know, he's just all over the place. But I've heard him talk. I've heard him twice talk about the traditions, and let me tell you, he does a good job of it. And if you haven't heard him talk about the tradition, then the next time he's in your area, then I hope you'll do that, because I can certainly recommend him. Let's give a warm welcome to Les W. He's from Kaufman, Texas.
I don't mind at all. That's the best that's been said about me in a long time. I'm an alcoholic, and my problem is less. By God's grace, the gift of this fellowship and people like you in rooms like this, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink today. That's been going on since August the 20th, 1977, and I'm very grateful for that. I want to thank the committee or whoever is responsible for having me here. It seems like since I got 20 years sober and that old-timer tag has been hung on me, I have been kind of busy. I was pretty busy earlier on, but I have really been busy, and I really like the idea of coming to a nice place like this and seeing people like you that I believe I've sat over here and I've looked y'all over pretty good, and I believe y'all are the best looking bunch of people I've ever seen with brain damage. I really do. Dang, y'all look good. I'd like to talk to those newcomers, the one that's under a year. I want to talk to you about when I was a newcomer. That was early this morning, by the way. When I got up this morning, I was brand new. I started a new day, see, and I had to do some things, and we're going to talk about that in the next 20 minutes. I want to talk about the night I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time. Well, I had already been here one time in 1971 and stayed 29 days. 29 of the most miserable days I've ever had in my whole life was spent with you people, from 71, January the 1st to the 29th. And I couldn't stand no more of it, and I had to go. There was a reason. I brought a disease, and I didn't treat it. And I had to go let the disease take some more of me. But in 1977, on September the 16th, my birthday, I was 41 years old. I was solicited into Alcoholics Anonymous by a lady that had 9 months. I had no designs on her. She had no designs on me. She asked me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't had a drink in 27 days. And I was ready to kill myself or kill somebody. I had a pint of whiskey in my car. And I said I would go with her that night, her and her sponsor. Her sponsor had 26 years at that time. And we drove to Athens, Texas, from Maybank, Texas. I met them in Maybank. And we drove that 20 miles, and we went. Right previous to that, on the 19th day of August, 1977, before I took my last drink, I had what every alcoholic must have. And that is that moment of clarity. That small bit of moment of clarity. And it came to me under a motel bed in Dallas, Texas, with my own excretion all over me, where I had been for 10 days. And I woke up, I'd just come unpassed for just a few seconds. And I had that moment of clarity, and that moment of clarity went through my head, and it said, you can't go on this way. You cannot go on this way. And I couldn't get out from under that bed. Somehow or another, I managed to get out from under that bed and made it to my mother's and daddy's from Dallas, Texas to Kemp, Texas. My dad was an elder in the Church of Christ. My mother was a devout preacher, a devout Christian. They didn't understand me, and I didn't understand them. Never did from the time I was little. But on that night, and I just spent 27 days without drinking, 27 days without any treatment, and I had that 29 to recall while I was with you people, and that was 56 days in my life that had been the most torture I've ever had in my life. And all I could think about in the back seat of that car going to that meeting was just exactly, is this the way the rest of my life is going to be? I saw a movie the other night, and most of you have probably seen it. It's got Jack Nicholson in it. It's called As Good As It Gets. And in that movie, Jack Nicholson walks around, and he was in this psychiatrist's office, and he walked around and looked at all these people, and he stood right in the middle of the room, and he looked at him, and he said, looked at him, and he said, what if this is as good as it gets? Well, that's what I thought I had right there. It was as good as it was going to get in the back seat of that car. And I did not look forward to that, because that was the most horror I had ever had. Oh, pardon me. I went to that meeting, and you gave me the biggest thing that you could possibly give me, and that was hope, H-O-P-E. They gave me, that bunch of drunks, gave me hope that there was a way up and a way out that I never had known before. And I got that hope, and I got just a minute bit of honesty. And I went home, and I called a man in Fort Worth and asked him if he would sponsor me, and he said no. He said, we don't sponsor people that get drunk, that drink alcohol. And I said, I hadn't had a drink in 27 days, and I just got back from my first meeting. He said, okay, I've got some rules for you. And I don't like rules, and you don't either. But he said, I said, what are your rules? He said, give up, grow up, show up, and shut up. And I did really think, what an order, I can't go through with it. But today that man is a very good friend of mine. He's my sponsor over here, his sponsor. And I will probably see him tonight because I'm going to be in Fort Worth doing the steps at his group, one of the groups he goes to. But I got started on a journey that has really, really come about. It has really, back in those days, and you know the older a man gets, the further he walks to school when he is a kid. But back in those days, we didn't have a place to go to meetings like we do now. There's an AA meeting, thank God, on every corner. In Tyler, Texas, there's one everywhere. But I want to tell you a couple of things that happened to me in this town. A couple of good things. There was a lot of good things happened to me in this town, in Alcoholics Anonymous. But let me tell you about two of them, that happened right here. And that was, at that time, there was a meeting down on Vine and Shaw. And I lived in Kemp, and I had to drive a long way to get to Tyler. And I thought it was a wasted trip. 75 miles. And I came as much as I could, because Athens had one meeting a week, and Malakoff had a meeting a week, and the rest of the time, I didn't have any meetings, and I had to come somewhere. And I came over here one night, and before I had gotten to you people, my mother's next-door neighbor, her husband had been dead about 2 months, and I mentioned the fact that all the treatment facilities and everywhere I'd ever got out of had given me some pills called Librium. And she said, I've got some. I said, I sure would like to have it because I sure am going to be nervous. I don't need to be nervous. And she gave me those, and I didn't know what I was doing. I took those Librium pills, and I started taking four a day, like the direction said for that other man that had died on the label. I was taking four a day, probably taking five, being an alcoholic. But I got out through with this triangle meeting one night, and I walked out and I headed to my car. And this young man, much younger than I was 41, he was probably 27, I don't remember his name. I remember he had a real pretty wife. That was very obvious. I remember that. But I saw him, and he walked up to me, and he said, is it really true that you want to stay sober? I said, yes, it sure is. I have really got to stay sober. He said, well, let me give you a hint. He said, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I've taken everything you can take. And he said, if the doctor has not prescribed them pills that you're taking, and I don't know what they are, but I would suggest you get rid of them. And because I don't believe in vulgarity and Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't believe I'm going to tell you what I told him. I got in my car and I headed back to camp and I was mad. Oh, I did not like what he said. And the longer I thought about it, the more sense it made. And I got down in the Kickapoo Bottom right outside of Chandler and I threw the pills out in Kickapoo Creek. That one act saved my life. I know he saved my life. I don't know who he is, but I know God knows. Because I know that I have talked about him a lot. And I am so grateful for what he did. Another time I came to you know, alcoholics, we're the most egotistical people there is. We either think we're the biggest or the best. You know, we think when we bat our eyes, everybody, it's dark on everybody. You know, we're so into ourselves. You know, and when I got here, I came to another meeting here one night to a bunch of guys, and I don't see but one or two of them out here in the audience, but you'll know who you are when I tell you about the meeting. Because we were having meetings back then on can you top this, you know. I got 5 minutes behind the podium, you got five, and I hate to be the first speaker because these other two can outdo me terrible bad. Because if the first speaker gets drunk when he was 15, the last one get drunk when he's in the womb if he has to. But I came to Tyler, Texas this Wednesday night, and I didn't know where I was going, but I knew where I was going, but I didn't know what they were doing. And I got inside of this church, and this guy, it was about seven guys there, six guys. And one of them said, do you have a 12-12? And I said, yes, I do. They said, well, you might ought to go get it. I walked out to the car and got it. Come in. We started the meeting. And the chairman was, his name was Paul L. And Paul and all the people around was talking about the eighth step. We read and we talked a little bit, and all of a sudden Paul started passing the basket, and I said, what kind of meeting is this? What kind of meeting do they have that was this interesting that can last just 10 or 15 minutes? And I looked up on the wall and there was a clock, and we'd been there an hour and a half. I was so mesmerized by that one talk on the 12 steps that I knew what I had read was true. I heard people talking about it. I didn't get in touch with my sponsor very much because I didn't need to because I was doing so well. And but I found the place that night. I found the place that night that I knew I needed to be. Jack said, give up. He said, give up. I gave up when I got up this morning. Because when I got up this morning, I didn't have a map for today if I didn't find that map. And that map had to come with putting those first three steps in my life. Because I asked God with His help this morning that I wouldn't take a drink of anything containing alcohol today. I will hear people in AA said, that's not in the big book. Show me where it's not. Because it says if I'm going to be of help to someone else, I better not take a drink of alcohol. Because if I take a drink, I ain't got a chance. You had neither if you're alcoholic. One drink. And if I don't take a drink, I've got a chance to do anything I want to do, be anything I want to be, and go anywhere I want to go. But I got up that morning and I gave up. And I got up this morning and gave up. And I've done it every morning since then. Since that way back a long time ago. And each day, I hear people say it gets better. Well, I believe that. But I'm going to tell you something. If Jack Nicholson says, what if this is as good as it gets? If this is it, that'll be fine. I'll take it. Because this beats anything I've ever had right here today, this morning. But I know that one thing for sure, that if I give up and I grow up. Growing up, I was one of the oldest kids there was in this country. I'd had a 41-year childhood, and I had enjoyed some of it. But I was still a kid. Jack had asked me every occasionally, what do you want to do when you get big? And I'd say, I'm 41. He said, I know that, but what do you want to do when you grow up? He said, you act like you're 15. Well, conversely, that's when I took my first drink, was when I was 15. And science has proved that the alcoholic will act the age that way the rest of his life if he doesn't get some help, because that's when our emotions stop growing. That is a scientific fact. And I was 15, and I wanted to grow up, and I had been told back a long time ago, before I got here, after I got out of the Terrell State Hospital, that I was going to drink again because I didn't change. I hadn't changed anything, and I didn't know how to change. I needed so much. I wanted so much to be like you people, and I didn't know how. I didn't know how to change. Wasn't going to know how to grow up till I got to step 6 and 7 of the program, because we don't. That's as far as I'm concerned. 6, 7, and 8 are the forgotten steps of the AA program, because sincerely, we don't ever talk about them. And yet, that's where the alcoholic starts growing up at, where we start finding out who we really, really are. The alcoholic comes in here, has no idea who he or she is, and nothing in the world. I didn't know who I was when I got here, because I was a mirror image of whoever I was around. Because I was going to cheat them out of something, I was going to take everything they had and walk off with it. And I didn't know who I was. I had to do a few certain things to find out how to grow up. And I'm going to tell you something, growing up is tough. Being responsible is tougher. I never have wanted to take a drink of alcohol since I've been in AA, but I sure have wanted to run a lot. I have. That would be my answer, is to run, because hasn't been many years ago this girl called our house, and I'm married to a girl, a lady that is 16 years my junior. She has a year longer sobriety than I've got, and she's from New York. And not to offend the gentleman that I see here that has a tag on from New York, but the big book wrote about her. It says they're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. And we talk a great deal about alcoholism in our house. We stay pretty close to alcoholism in our house, because that's what this whole life is all about. But, you know, she was not the first marriage I had, and I hope to God it's the last one, because I have a very strange thing. When I drink, I marry a lot. I thought wedding cake was one of the four main food groups when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had my own marriage license that said to whom it may concern. And I could say the vows in two different languages at one time. And it's a long way from here to there. But being 22 years sober, 22 years and 2 months, and 4 months and a few days, does not make me immune from that next drink of alcohol. Because, you see, I need to give up, I need to grow up, and more than that, I need to show up. But going to meetings must be. But going to meetings by itself is no good if all you're going to do is go to the meetings and have fellowship. You go to the meetings and you put the 12 steps in your life, and you've got one of the grandest, greatest things that's ever been presented to mankind in this world. Simply because all of you have heard the term billions of times the last 6 months. It's called Y2K. We didn't have to worry about Y2K in Alcoholics Anonymous, because, you see, we already fit. Alcoholics Anonymous, we didn't need to worry about it being going to change, because till the treatment changes, till the disease changes, the treatment's not going to change. And the disease has been the same ever since Man Crush Grape. And the treatment has been the same since Bill Wilson wrote those 12 steps in 1938. And because of that and those steps, I need today just as much or more, because I've got something to lose today. I didn't have anything to lose that night, because in the back of that car on the way home, that old man was, he had 28 years sober. Not only that, he had a lot of years behind him to boot. He qualified as an old timer in every way. And he couldn't stay on the road because the old man had something else on his mind. He put me in the front seat. And by putting me in that front seat, he put that woman in the back seat that had asked me to come with her. And he drove about half on the road and half off the road. But in a 20-mile span and 30-minute drive, that old man went through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with me. He told me what each step meant and what would happen if I did this. I'd give all I've got right now for a tape of that talk. Because that night, I knew that without a doubt, there was something out here that could help me. And I wasn't going to be miserable anymore. Because misery's got a handle on it. I can reach down and pick it up today and carry it with me and let it load me down as long as I want to. Doesn't matter that I've had a few days sober. What does matter is what I do today about the disease I've got today. Because, like I said, until the disease changes, the treatment won't change. And the treatment is still the same. And the treatment's the same for us up here that's got this 175 years as it is for the person in this room that might not have but 30 days. But I will tell you something. It will enlarge itself tremendously as you go along. Tremendously as you go along. If you will get a sponsor and do what is asked of you to do in that big book in that 12 and 12, you cannot fail. And if you're new here and you don't think the Alcoholics Anonymous won't work, try it. If you don't think God will help you, ask Him. Because you see, I thank God that I found Alcoholics Anonymous. But more than that, I thank Alcoholics Anonymous that I found my God. And I want to tell you something. This is one of the best days that I've ever seen. And if this is as good as it gets, I'll take it. I love you. Thank you.
Boy, Les, he done good, didn't he? And I didn't know this next speaker. He was recommended to me, and he comes highly recommended. But I talked to him several times on the phone, and I learned just enough about him to know that I wanted to hear more from him. So without any more from me, how about a nice hand for Jim S. from Fort Worth?
Thank you, Jim. I'm Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. My sobriety date, June 26, 1968. And that's through God's grace and your love in my life. And I want to thank Jim for calling and asking me to come in the committee and the convention. It's a real honor to be asked to come and share in Alcoholics Anonymous anywhere. It's certainly one small way that I can give back a little bit of what's been given to me. And I've been given a whole lot. And it gets better than this, believe me. It's good today, but it even gets better than this. I found that out all through my sobriety. It gets better than this. Appreciate being here with Cersei. I admire Cersei, and because Cersei's got the quality and quantity of sobriety that he's got, and he still makes meetings. And I need to see that. I need older sobriety in my life and in my sobriety. And I need somebody to look up to. And not that I don't look up to younger sobriety, but people like Cersei and when David A. was here and others were very important to my sobriety. And Cersei certainly important in that I can look at him today and he's still making meetings. And I admire some things about Les Williams, but I'll think of them in a minute and I'll tell me one of them. I started drinking when I was 14. I'd wanted to drink earlier. My father was alcoholic, and my mother was strong in her church, and that's probably what held things together as much as it was. And I was a baby of four boys. Didn't have a whole lot when I was growing up, and a lot of people didn't, but it seemed like we had even worse or less. And that has nothing to do with my alcoholism. It's just that I could have used a drink back when I was a lot younger. You know, I can't blame my alcoholism on mother's church, and I can't blame it on dad's alcoholism. But it seems like that people around us had a little bit more, and that I just didn't fit in. And I heard a lady talk one time that said that when she was 7 years old, the doctor prescribed 3 beers a day for her. She had some kind of ailment. And I thought to myself, I could have used 3 beers a day when I was 7 years old. In fact, I could have used a six-pack. But because when I found that drink at 14, it opened the doors for me to change the way I felt. And from that time on, that was the reason that I drank, was to change the way I felt. It changed a lot of those old things that I grew up with, changed a lot of inadequacies. Nobody ever told me I was inadequate. I just something that I came up with in my own mind. I guess because a lot of times we play, when I was a kid, we'd play hide-and-go-seek, nobody would hunt me. And maybe that's why I got that feeling. But I could take a drink of whiskey, and all of that stuff would go away. Or I could drink several beers and all that stuff would go. And I felt normal. And I didn't see anything wrong with that. I knew that alcoholism was wrong because of the way Dad drank and the problems it caused. But I wasn't going to be that way. I was going to be sensible about my drinking and going to not let it get the best of me. and so on and so forth. And so I could justify that it was okay for me to have some drink. And when I started drinking, I didn't say, boy, this stuff is good. I'm going to be an alcoholic. I didn't say that. I said it's good, but I didn't, you know, I was going to be trying not to be an alcoholic. And didn't want to be an alcoholic. I just wanted to have a few drinks and maybe get about this high off the ground and kind of float around and relieve all that misery and have fun and laugh and cut up. Couldn't do it without a drink. I didn't want to, all that other stuff to come with it, but I couldn't stay this high very long. I'd collapse and fall down. I'd have to try to come back up. And I was like the drunks that went in the liquor store and asked for a fifth of Old Squirrel whiskey. And the clerk looked around and came back and said, sir, we don't have any Old Squirrel. And we got some Old Crow. And the drunk said, no, I don't want to fly. I just want to hop around a little bit. You know? And that's all I really wanted to do. But as I continued to drink, things began to happen inside of me, you know, and it took a little more to get up here. And it took a little more to stay up there. And all of this began to cause a few problems along. I'd married, and we were having children, and I had a responsible job that I really liked and had wanted for a long, long time. But I was beginning to have problems in those areas. Now, of course, I was in denial, and it wasn't alcohol that was causing these problems. It was them, and it was circumstances, and it was bad luck. I had a lot of bad luck, you know, and I didn't have the breaks that other people had. And it was a struggle for me, and it was them. And so I continued to drink, and when there was, as the illness progressed, you know, and the consequences began to get greater, you know, I could stop drinking for a while. And it always had to be a crisis, though. I could never quit drinking on a beautiful day like today when everything was going okay. It was always after a crisis. And I could come off of that alcohol for a while and do that white knuckle sobriety or being dry for a while. But as the book says, eventually I get restless, irritable, and discontent. And things, I'd see that something would happen that where I would have to have a drink. And I'd run it by the committee in my head, and the committee in my head would say, if you take a drink, you'll go to jail. If you take a drink, you'll get kicked out of the house. Or if you take a drink, you'll get suspended from your job. And I'd eventually tell the committee, I said, I can't help that right now. I need a drink, and I'll take care of those other problems when they come. Right now, I've got to have some relief. And I didn't know all this at the time. I didn't know it. Usually, I would set up a situation where I can have a beer or two. I never really did want just a beer or two. But that was a good way to get started into a drunk. And usually, I did. And that progressed, and eventually I lost that job that I had that I cared so much about after 13 years, and the bottom fell out of everything else. By this time, alcohol wasn't any fun. There was none of this getting up here, hardly getting off the floor. I was having these thoughts of despair, paranoid, and things were getting worse and closing in on me. And my magic elixir had let me down. These fears and anxieties that I had when I started drinking, it wouldn't go away now. They were back and they were there and they were 10 times stronger. And I hadn't, all through the years, I hadn't developed a coping mechanism to deal with these problems, and now they were still happening and the alcohol wouldn't make them go away. And I was in a heck of a mess. And thought the only way I knew out that would come to my mind was suicide. And I thought a lot about suicide, talked about suicide, wrote suicide notes, and jumped in front of a parked car 2 or 3 times. You know, and it was, when that alcohol quits working, you're really hopeless. I already felt hopeless, and I couldn't figure another way out. And I couldn't possibly, in my mind, grasp that even if I could do without alcohol, that I would live long enough to straighten up this mess that I'd strung out behind me in the last 23 years. The people I'd hurt, the people I'd abused, my family, my children. We had four children, just like in my home, and I was a much worse alcoholic than my dad was, and was doing more damage to my children than Dad did to us. And I could see it in their eyes and in their expression. And I knew what they were thinking, because I'd gone through the very same thing. And I was powerless to do any different. And this is where I was eventually when one night about 11:30, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And a man answered the telephone, and he said we talked for a long time. And I was lucid during that time, but I didn't remember that we spent nearly an hour on the phone, he said. But during that time, I was making pretty good sense, evidently. Anyway, he said, I'll come out to your house tomorrow at 4 o'clock and we'll talk some more. And we hung up the phone, and I went to bed, and the next day at 4 he came. And then that was June 26, 1968. That's when I took my last drink. And I took my last drink while he was there. And he said, pardon me, he said, you told me over the telephone last night that you wouldn't drink anymore till I got here. And I thought to myself, well, I wasn't that lucid. I don't remember making a deal like that. And I've thought since then, what difference would it make anyway if I could have a drink when he got there? But anyway, that fine man talked to me, and we talked there in the living room, and he said, well, my children were there, my wife was there, and he said, there's a meeting tomorrow night at Meadowbrook, if you and your wife, this is a Meadowbrook group in Fort Worth, that if you and your wife want to go with me and my wife. And I said, we would. He didn't say, well, what's it like? What's the initiation going to be like? What are the dues? How much would it cost me? What do I have to do? He just said, there's a meeting, and do you want to go? And I said, yes. 5 years before that, when I was in psychiatric ward in Fort Worth, the doctor said, would you like to go to an AA meeting? I said, no, I'm not going down in front of those people and talk about my personal business. But see, 5 years of drinking after that, I'd become perfectly teachable. I had no reservations, no excuses, or anything else. And when he said, there's a meeting, you want to go, I said, yes. Well, the next night was Thursday. And when 7 o'clock came to get ready to go to that meeting, I was too sick. I hadn't had anything to drink for probably 27, 28 hours, and I was coming apart. And I called the man and said, I'm too sick to go. And he said, well, our next meeting is Saturday at 8 o'clock. And I went to the Saturday night meeting, and my first meeting. I wasn't feeling a whole lot better. My blood pressure was so high, probably every time my heart beat, my hair stood up. And I was still jumping, I was still waving at people. But I went to my first meeting, and they called for new people. They'd been in the meeting for the first time, and I went up. And they gave me my chip, and they said, what's your name? I was crying so bad they couldn't understand me. And they asked me again. I said, I'm Jim, I'm an alcoholic. First time I'd ever said that, or even thought about that. Now, but it was such a relief, emotional relief for me. The load was lifted off of me. See, I was a tough guy, and this whiskey wasn't going to whip me and like to kill me. If I'd been that much tougher, I would have died. Tough guys don't get sober. Tough gals don't get sober. But I found out after I got into the steps that you got to be sober, you got to be tough to stay sober. I found that out. But anyway, the night that I came to my first meeting, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the whole program was put at my feet that night and was there for me, and I could have had the whole program that first night. But I didn't have a container large enough to take it home in. My container was about the size of a pea, so I couldn't take much AA home with me. What I took home with me was the feeling of being accepted, welcomed, and you came up to me after the meeting and introduced yourself, and some of the men gave me some phone numbers,
And that was a beautiful feeling, and the greeting and relief that I got. That's what I took home with me the first night. I don't remember who the speaker was. But as I continued to make meetings, my container got bigger. And as time went on, I had a larger container, and I could scoop up more of the program and take it home with me. I could have had the whole program any time, but I didn't have a container big enough for it. And that's how I started out in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a simple thing, and thank God it was. You heard Les talk about how he starts his day. And you shared that with me in the early days of my sobriety. I believed in God, and I didn't understand how to believe. I had a lot of ignorance and misunderstanding about God. And I left God alone for 23 years. But you shared with me that you started your day by asking God to help you not take a drink today and thanked him when you went to bed sober at night. And I started doing that in the early days of my sobriety. And it felt good to talk to God again. And that's still part of my prayer each day now. And it was a simple thing that you sharing, another alcoholic sharing with this alcoholic, that I was able to identify and like what I saw and understand what I was hearing, and that kept drawing me back to Alcoholics Anonymous and the relief I got. Remember, I drank for relief to start with. Now I'm coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm getting relief. I'm getting support and I'm getting strength. And it's through this program. And it's through the simple way and the healing process starts that has kept me coming back. And it's still important for me to come back today. No matter where I am, if I'm at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I feel safe. I feel okay. And when I leave, I feel even better. And my sponsor worked with me, and we began to get into the steps and begin to gradually have a return of this self-esteem. We gradually have a return of confidence. And the longer I was sober, the less I needed a drink. I was beginning to fulfill all of my needs in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and still do today. I was talking about it gets better than this, but there's times that the bottom falls out. But, you know, that's with everybody has to experience that. And I have to go back to the basics when that happens and remember that I'm an alcoholic and that I've got some tools that most people don't have outside of Alcoholics Anonymous to help me through these problems. The Serenity Prayer is one that sometimes I overlook it. It's so simple and it means so much to me if I really pray the words as I say them. Thank you again for letting me come and share and be with you on this day, and I appreciate it very much. And I love all of you, and thank you for your help.
I told you you're going to be a good speaker. This next guy has been sober longer than just about everybody. In fact, I figured that if he'd got here a little bit sooner, he might have got here before AA got here. I calculated, and the best I can tell, he got here when he was about 4 years old. I had never met him. He came to me highly recommended, and I talked to him several times on the phone, and the last time I talked to him, he said, "You know, Jim," he said, "when you get to be my age," he said, "there's a couple of things you can't do very well anymore." I said, "Is that right?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "One is you get where you can't remember too well." And he said, "I forget what the other one was." But, Cersei, when you get up here, if you happen to remember what that other one was, just spit it out, because we'd all like to hear. Without any more of this foolishness, let's have a nice towel of welcome for Cersei W. from Fort Worth.
He's going to get in trouble with Fort Worth because I'm from Dallas. Well, they both claim me. Fort Worth claimed I'm from Dallas. Dallas claimed I'm from Fort Worth. It's nice to be claimed for something, anyhow, if you're an alcoholic like me. And my name is Cersei, and I'm a real alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the help of all of you peoples, Al-Anon, Al-Ateens, Al-Tots, Al-Tors, and Al-Betweens, and all that, you have given me sobriety since May 10th, 1946. And for that, I'm deeply grateful. The only reason I mentioned the length of my sobriety is because I'm damn proud of it. That's the only reason I mentioned it. So anyhow, if you want to laugh or cry or leave, let's go ahead. Let's stand up just a minute and rest our bottoms. Will you, everybody, stand up a minute? They say that your mind can absorb only what your bottom can stand. I've heard that. Thank you. Well, you know, I hope, and the reason they don't allow drunkologues anymore is because of we old timers. You know, if I went into my drunkologue, we'd be here 4 days and nights, and then that'd just be the beginning. So anyhow, 20 minutes we're allowed up here, and I can barely introduce myself as slow as I talk in 20 minutes, but we'll cover some ground that I've been over and see if we have anything to identify with. Truly, incidentally, Dr. Charlie, you talk about somebody being faithful. He's been sitting in that chair for 53 years, right there. And he's done a hell of a good job, too. I tell you, all that committee, I've been coming down here for 50 years, I know. And incidentally, I remember in January of 1947, I was heading down here to their first meeting in the hotel. And I ran out of gas in Mineola, and I didn't make the meeting. That's the reason I wasn't one of the beginners. I ran out of gas. Anyhow, you know, drunkologues are sacred to us because that's what happened to us. Truth. All of our drunkologues essentially are the same because you did it in one bar and I did it in another one, but we all wound up in the same pot. The same problem. We couldn't drink alcohol. And we all alike. So where the difference, there's an old guy from Emory over there, and you talk about the face of an alcoholic, look at him. But everywhere you go all over the world, there he is. There he is. And I would see that sign all the time, said, wherever you are, be there. And that was a terrible thing for me to discover. Because I tried that geographical cure a lot of times, and wherever I was, there I was. You know, that is the trouble. If I could have left that guy back where he came from, it'd been all right. Well, anyhow, as a matter of history, and I was raised on a farm out in West Texas, and a sorry farm. I never saw a good one. And we were poor, poor as hell. And I finally got off that farm, went to a little town called Stanford, Texas, out in West Texas, to finish high school. And I stayed with my old aunt of mine who had a boarding house, and that was pretty good. I ate everything I could get in touch with then, coming off that farm, you know. And anyhow, I finished high school, and an old schoolmate of mine that I want to refer to later, named Stuart Hamblin, finished high school with me in Stanford, Texas. And I went on to Midland, Texas, to play semi-pro baseball in the old West Texas League. And I was a pitcher of sorts, if you want to call them that. And anyhow, it's a matter of I've got a story about an old boy. We had a guy, a third baseman named Red Hill. And we had our baseball manager had a funeral parlor. And his name was Doc Ellis, Doc Ellis Funeral Parlors. So after the games on Sunday, after we played baseball, we usually lost, but we'd get together at the funeral parlor and celebrate with home brew. And none of you, not many of you know about home brew. There's one over there. And there's a few around. You have to be old, you know, to know about home brew. It's made out of macaroni and cheese and something. It's fermented. It'll make you drunk. That's all I know about it. Well, we met at the funeral party this day, and I'm sure we had lost. But Red Hill was a sorry drinker, and I never did like to drink with a sorry drinker. And Red would take two or three drinks and just pass out. And that was terribly disturbing to we who could drink successfully. So we decided we'd get even with Red, and we picked him up and put him in a casket. And after he passed out, and we folded his arms and put flowers around on him, this and that, the other, decorated him real nicely, and we stood back listening and drinking and acting silly, of course. And we wanted to see what Red's reaction would be. And he finally aroused a little bit, and he looked around and felt of himself and looked up and around. He said, "Well, if I'm not dead, why am I here? And if I am dead, why do I have to go to the bathroom?" I think Red came into the program later on. Well, playing baseball, they gave us a job. They gave me one. Most of them worked for a big oil company. They sponsored players to, and some of them went to the big leagues. But they gave me a job with a big motor company, and along the line, I became general manager of that company. And the owners of that company lived right here in Tyler at Walt Schwoder, Walco Products, and they owned this motor company that I worked for. They had Dodge trucks and all from El Paso to Abilene to El Paso. So I had to do a lot of drinking, being in the automobile business, to entertain your customers. You know, that's necessary to get business. You have to entertain, you know. And boy, did I entertain. And I'll tell you, I entertained and entertained and entertained. And somewhere down the line, if you have that X factor in your life, whatever that is, I don't know. But if you have that in there and you keep adding alcohol to it in large doses over a period of time, you may cross that line into compulsive pathological drinking. That's the only kind of drinking that's a disease. But when you have to drink to get away from the effects of drinking, that's the disease, alcoholism. And that's what I had to do. So when you hit that, then you become confused. And we wonder what's happened. I used to could drink and go to work and stay up all night and this and that and the other. But now it's different and something's happened. So we're bewildered and we're frustrated and we're despaired. And you lose your self-esteem. You lose all these things as you go along, and it just gets worse. But you keep trying harder to handle it, try to figure out some way. I tried every known method to try to handle alcohol successfully. And I took the geographical tour after this. That's unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. If you ever had that, I don't know. I moved off to different places incidentally, I've got three important numbers in my life right now. And they're not my measurements. These are not my size. I'm 89 years old. I've been married to the same woman 65 years, and I've been sober 53 years. And I'm going to hold on to those numbers today. I don't give a damn what happens. I'm not taking a drink today, you know. So though we have to have some kind of something that's important to us to help us in sobriety. Well, after many geographical cures, I ran into an old drinking buddy of mine out there, and he told me that what happened to him. And I knew he was a sorry drinker. And he said, I asked him to go have a drink with me, and he said, "I'll go with you." And after a couple of drinks, he said, "Go ahead, you need a drink." And I took a drink. He said, I'll tell you what happened to me. He said, "And you know I'm a sorry drinker." And I would get up and drive. He had moved to Dallas. And he said, "I'd get up at night and drive with a carload of liquor, and I ran into a carload of ladies, and three of them were killed." And he and his mother owned a big oil company up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He said, "You can imagine the lawsuits and the problems, and to know that you have killed somebody drinking booze drunk." And he said, "I found a group called Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "We meet there in Dallas. There's 14 of us. And we meet and talk about our drinking escapades and what happened to us and how we lost jobs and money. And we don't drink anymore." He said, "I haven't had a drink in 10 months. And I couldn't believe that he had ever gone 10 months or even a day without a drink. And I liked to be around him. He kept me drunk for a long time. He had a lot of money. He was a sorry drinker. He'd pass out. I'd steal his money and just stay drunk. And it was a big help to me to become an alcoholic, you know. I ran out of money sometime. I know none of you ever had that happen, but I did. So, anyhow, he said, "When you go as far as you can go, you can't go another step, you call me and I'll try to help. You need some help." So I'd stay drunk from then until April of 1946, and I remembered what he told me. And I went to Dallas and looked Bob up, and he put me in a little drying out joint. That's all we had then. And they give you a drink every 4 hours of Jack Daniels or something like that. And I'd been drinking a pint every 4 hours, so you can imagine how good that was. And anyhow, the third day there, for some unknown reason, and let me talk a little about God's providence with us and why he is necessary in our life. You know, I'm a recovering Baptist, and I haven't completely recovered, but I'm still a recovering Baptist. I've baptized 4 or 5 times, but I had to come to AA to find God as I understand it. I couldn't find it in the church. I didn't find it there. Anyhow, for some unknown reason, and only by the grace of God, that second day, after being drunk for solid every day and night for 6 months, I didn't need a drink for some unknown reason. They told me, they said, "We're going to take you to AA." And we went downtown Dallas, 912 and a half Main, and parked in front of a liquor store. And then I knew AA had worked when we parked in front of the liquor store. But we didn't go in there. We went upstairs. And here were these guys, and they're happy, joyous, and free, and all of them said they were alcoholics. I didn't believe that. By the grace of God, something and somebody happens in our lives that make a difference. Somebody introduces us to an understanding of how to stay sober on a daily basis, and it sticks for somebody. And every single one of you here are the only one that can help somebody that's still looking for a way out there. You're the only one. Nobody else. And we have to remember that we think, well, our sobriety is not... We're responsible to stay sober because somebody won't have to die if we stay sober. So, I stayed there in that drying out joint, and then I went to... I asked this old Irishman down there, I said, "How long have you been in here sober enough?" He said, 18 weeks. And I said, "My God, I'm going out of here Saturday drunk or sober." Because he paid me for a week in there. And anyhow, this guy took it at AA, and I'll never forget it. And he probably was the only one in the 14 that would have given me this very method that helped me stay sober. Because I lived where there were no groups of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was not a group of AA between Fort Worth and Phoenix, Arizona, when I came in. Not a group. This guy marched me to the board, and there was 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, "This is a design for living. But don't worry about doing these steps and experience these steps now. You've got to have a way to stay sober, to not drink." I said, "How in the hell would you not drink? How could I not drink?" I couldn't imagine any way in my life that I could not have to drink. And he said, here's what I do. He said, "Before I get up in the morning, I make a commitment, not a promise. Your promises are not worth a damn. And your propositions are no good. You propositioned God, you propositioned everybody, your wife and everybody else, that you would not drink. It didn't work. I want you to commit to God. Do you believe in God?" I said, "Yes, I believe in God. I want you to commit to that, to God, that you'll not take a drink just for today. Can you go 24 hours without a drink?" I said, "I can do that. I can't go a week. I can't go a month. And damn sure can't go a year. I've made New Year's resolutions a lot of times. Didn't work." So, because, and by the grace of God, he gave me a way not to drink until we could form groups of Alcoholics Anonymous where I could join in and be a part of it. They're going to have a countdown here tonight of ages and sobriety. And when it comes to 53, I want every one of you to stand up for me, because I can't be here. But I want you to stand because you've been the cause of me being able to stay sober for 53 years. Every one of you, not me. You did it. And I want to thank you for it, and I want to thank you for your help. And that's the way these things work to me. Well, anyhow, I stayed sober by the grace of God until we could get a few groups going, like this group when we first started here. All over the country there, old Dr. Black down at Palestine, and here and there, there would be a lone alcoholic out there. They'd have a big book, and that's all. And we'd go help them start a group. Old Dr. Black was a dentist down in Palestine, and another guy and I were traveling, worked for Yale University School on Alcohol Studies out in the Southwest. And old Dr. Black called us every one time and said, "I need to look at your teeth." And it wasn't that we didn't. He didn't care about our teeth. He wanted to have an AA meeting. That's how lonely it was then. And we'd come down here and go to meetings every little place, Lufkin, Tyler, and Longview, and whatever, help each other. And it worked because we helped each other and because we showed up and suited up and shut up and tried to help somebody stay sober. And if we ever forget where we came from, we'll never forget where we're going. Because if we don't care where we came from and what happened and how, those first people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I refer back now to Bill and Dr. Bob, that paved the way and stayed the course until they could put this thing together and make it work and know that it will work, and thank God for those people that stayed the course. But if we don't care about that and what they did, then we don't care where we're going. We have to remember where we came from and how it happened. So anyhow, I stayed sober, and in the meantime, in the latter part of 46, we had the first state convention in Austin, Texas, at St. Edward University. And Bill and Lois Wilson came down there to that first state convention. And I went down there. I wanted to see how old Bill's wings flopped. You know, I'd heard about it. And I wanted to see what kind of angel he was. And I found out. And we formed a friendship that was very close for many, many years. Bill and Lois and my wife and I traveled together. We went to conventions together. We did things together. We visited them in their home in Bedford Hills. And they came to see us. And by the grace of God, He helped me stay sober those early days of AA, and by knowing Him. Well, I worried the hell out of Bill about all. I wanted to know the facts, all about these things that about AA and about alcoholism. He said, "Why in the hell don't you go to the Yale School and learn these things? You're so inquisitive." I said, "How do I go?" He said, "I'll send you." He wanted to get rid of it, you know. And I went, and I learned everything he wants to know about AA and everything about alcoholism. Oh boy, I had the knowledge. And I came back home, I wanted to spread it. And I thought we could go in bars and this and that and the other and pull them out. And any way to get members of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what we wanted, I thought we should do. Well, anyhow, of course that didn't work, but we went out there to hospitals and churches and schools, and we formed committees on alcoholism in cities all over the Southwest. And to some extent, there was some education with the general public about with knowledge about alcoholism and what it is and what we need to do on a community basis. And, well, anyhow, then Dr. Jelinek was a banana scientist. He came from South America, and they hired him at Yale University to be head of the alcohol school, alcohol studies. And I asked him, he's a little short, check guy about this tall, and I asked him, I said, "How in the hell did you go from bananas to alcoholic?" And he said, "They're just alike. They get away from the bunch, they get peeled." That made sense. Scientifically, that made sense to me. All right. So, anyhow, well, he became ill, and he said, "The greatest need we have in this country is a hospital where an alcoholic can go into as an alcoholic with a disease, alcoholism, and get treatment, medical treatment, and find a way and have Alcoholics Anonymous in there in day and night to take those people to meetings, and they'll stay sober." And that's what happened. 75% of them got sober. They had four hospitals scattered all over the Southwest. And we had 10 or 12, 15,000 people, and none of them had any money, and none of us had any money. But somehow or another, we survived, and because of Alcoholics Anonymous being in those clinics, hospitals, they stayed sober because they found a way. They'd take them to AA, they'd sponsor them, and before there were sponsors. And so, you can imagine in those early days trying to, and we talk about all the successes and all the things we have not to drink anymore and the steps. I want to tell you some of the things we tried early on that didn't work. And here are the 12 steps before the real 12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over nothing, that we could manage our lives perfectly and those of anyone else who would allow us to. We came to believe there was no power greater than ourselves and the rest of the world was insane. We made a decision to have our loved ones and friends turn their will and lives over to our care, even though they couldn't understand us at all. We made a searching and fearless moral and immoral inventory of everybody we knew. We admitted to the whole world at large the exact nature of everyone else's wrong. We were entirely ready to make others straighten up and ship out and do right. We demanded others to shape up or ship out. We made a list of all persons who had harmed us and became willing to get even with all of them. We got direct revenge to those where possible, except when to do so would cost us a jail sentence at least. We continued to take inventory of others, and when they were wrong, promptly reminded them of it. We thought through bitching and nagging to improve our relations with others, as they couldn't understand us at all, asking only that they knuckle under our and do things our way. Having had a complete physical, emotional, and spiritual breakdown as a result of these steps, we try to blame it on others and get sympathy and pity in all our affairs. Thank you. But yeah, although those are the early the steps, we had early promises too. And those things that were important to me, the early promises that we had, and these are some of them, these are the 12 early promises. You'll know your full name and address. You'll be able to shave yourself. You'll be able to dress and undress yourself at the appropriate time and places. You at all time know the city, state, and country you're in. You'll routinely be able to find matching socks. You'll be able to smoke if you wish without burning holes in your clothes or the furniture. You'll lose the fear of food. You will spend less time in the bathroom. You'll be able to walk a straight line past the balloon test. You'll lose the fear of police cars in your rearview mirror. You'll be able to answer the door without looking through the keyhole first. You'll realize what a mess you've been and thank God for AA and Al-Anon. Go ahead, that's right, yeah. But the real 12 rewards of Alcoholics Anonymous are these. Faith instead of despair. Courage instead of fear. Hope instead of desperation. Peace of mind instead of confusion. Real friendships instead of loneliness. Self-respect instead of self-contempt. Self-confidence instead of helplessness. A clean conscience instead of a sense of guilt. The respect of others instead of their pity and contempt. A clean pattern of living instead of a purposeless existence. The love and understanding of our families instead of their doubts and fears. The freedom of a happy life instead of the bondage of an alcoholic obsession. And those are the real rewards of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Back one thing to, I told you I finished high school with a guy named Stuart Hamblin, and he was a songwriter. And he went out to Hollywood and worked out there for years, and he became an alcoholic. But in the meantime, he wrote a lot of songs that were very good, like This Old House, and various old songs like that, and he wrote one, and incidentally he got sober 2.5 years before he died and called me if I'd be a sponsor. And in talking to him, I said, there's one song you wrote, and I think you must have had Alcoholics Anonymous in mind when you wrote it. And he said, what's that? And I said, the title of it is, It Is No Secret What God Can Do. And it goes like this. The chimes of time ring out the news another day is through. Someone slipped and fell. Was that someone you? You may have longed for added strength or courage to renew. Do not be disheartened, because I've got news for you. It is no secret what God can do. There is no night for any light. You'll never walk alone. You'll always feel at home wherever you may roam. There is no power can conquer you while God is on your side. Just take him at his promise. Don't run away and hide. It is no secret what God can do. And I told him, I think he must have had AA and us in mind when he wrote that, because it's very appropriate to our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, if we look, the threads of spirituality are woven through all of the fabric of AA, every bit of it. Look back at this. There were first thing was old Bill Wilson in the town's hospital for the 40th time, drunk. And an old school buddy, Ebby, came in. And he was sober. And Bill said, "What is this religion you've got?" "Well," he said, "it's not religion." He said, "We have four absolutes and this and that and the other." But he said, "What's the bottom line? What do you do?" And all the years we've been in Alcoholics, we have not improved any, and we must remember that these are the important thing. And he said, he asked Ebby, "What is this you do? What do you do?" He said, "We trust God, clean house, and help others. We trust God, clean house, and help others." And old Bill thought about it, and he was agnostic, didn't believe in God, but that night he got on his knees, and he said, "If there is a God, show himself to me." And he did. And he had that soft wind blew him, you know his story in the big book. Something happened, he never took another drink. 6 months later, old Ebby went out and got drunk again, went down to the Bowery in New York. And he stayed down there for 11 years. And I told you we had those hospitals. And I asked Bill one time, he came to Dallas, we were visiting. I said, "What would you like to see happen that's never happened in AA?" He said, "I'd like to see Ebby have a chance to get sober, because he helped me get sober. He's my sponsor." That's what Bill said. And he always was his sponsor. Well, anyhow, we got Ebby down to the hospital in Dallas. And after several weeks, he's finally sobered up, and he's mad as hell at Dr. Bob, Bill, and AA, and everybody else. Resentful and terrible. But one day he said, "Want to know where I was going?" I said, "I'm going over to the group." He said, "What group?" I said, "Hell, you know what group, the Alcoholics Anonymous. Can I go with you?" He went. The next day he went and stayed all day. The next day he went and stayed all day. And the next week he went to Lubbock, Texas with me, a talk out there. And he got up and said, "My name is Ebby, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm sure glad to be sober and back in AA." That's what happened. That's what Bill said. Don't give up. And stay with it until somebody, maybe I can't help him, but somebody can. So, look at this. Old Bill, sober 6 months, and he goes to Akron to make a stock deal. And you know, some of us decide after we get sober that we'll go back to work. And old Bill did. And he went to Akron to make a deal to sell a rubber plant. And the deal fell through, and there he was in the Mayflower Hotel with $10. And in Akron, he had to go back to New York. And that's when he went down in the basement of the hotel to the Mayflower, and there were 40 churches listed down there. 40. And don't you think this is the grace of God? He picked out the only one, I think, that would have done what he did. And read the Reverend Tunks, that he called, said, "I know a lady who is a doctor's wife, and they need help." And he called Henrietta Cyberling, and she called Ann Smith, and they got together. Well, do you think that there was 40 people listed, 40 churches listed in there? If you pick one, but I bet the other 39 said, "Go to hell, I don't want anything to do with drugs." But that one guy said, "Yes, I'll put you in touch with somebody." That's the grace of God. And it has to be. If you look all through the fabric of AA, we find where there is God. And then look at these first 100 people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They had 100 that gotten together, and 25 of them were agnostic. They didn't believe in God. And so they Bill Wilson told them they met. And all of them, the agnostics and all, said, "We admit we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives are unmanageable." "Yes, we admit that." And they met, and they met, and they met. "And what do you do from here? What do we do from here?" And there was no place to go. So finally they said, "We came to believe. We came to believe in the power greater than ourselves." And if you look how these things were, these steps were not written Bill Wilson or nobody sat down and wrote these steps. They did those things, and as a result, they stayed sober. And that's the reason we have Alcoholics Anonymous today. So I just leave you with this, with much gratitude to all of you, and I challenge all of you that we abandon ourselves to God as we understand God, clear away the wreckage of the past, admit our faults to each other, and I have no doubt that somewhere, some way, somehow, all of us down the line will meet again. Somewhere, some way, sometime. And until then, God bless all of you, and I hope you'll come to the Eagles Gathering in Dallas in May. Thank you very much, and I love every one of you. Did I go over 20 minutes? I'll get this out of here.
Thank you, old friend.
Thank you.
There you go, 19 minutes and 59 seconds, right on the money. I want to thank the speakers. I think you did a good job. Sonny B., thank you for reading the how it works. And the rest of you, thank you for showing up. And thank you for being so patient with us. And Robert's going to wind this thing up for us.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank everyone for being here this morning. It's been an honor and a privilege to be on the stage with 175 years of sobriety. That's absolutely incredible. When I think about Cersei sobered up when I was 3 years old, that kind of puts it in the right perspective for me. Thank you all for being here. Let me make some brief announcements, and then we'll close in the usual manner here. Please clean up around your area again, if you would. We'd greatly appreciate that. The barbecue will be at 6 p.m., please be there for that. We'll have a good time, fun, food, and fellowship. Tickets are $6. This afternoon, please be here about 3:45, and we'll hear Charlie C. from Los Angeles. So if there are any other announcements, I'm sorry, okay, Al-Anon at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Okay, thank you very much. If that's it, then let's close in the usual manner. We'll join hands and we'll recite the Lord's Prayer. Who keeps us sober?
Our Father, which art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come,
thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven.
Give
us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us.
And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
Thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory,
forever and ever.
Amen. Keep coming back. It works if you work.
Dad, you know, enjoy it.
Well, it works. Thank you, Dale. My pleasure.
Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Good to see you.
Enjoyed it. Good luck with your anniversary up in Dallas.